funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? I'm a clown? I'm a clown?
Rosebud.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Silver Screen Video, and this is our second 2023 episode. I don't know, at what point do we stop recognizing that it's a new year? You know, like the old thing, like, at what point do you stop saying happy holidays and shit like that? Like, when do you think we should stop recognizing that it's no longer 2022?
I think now would be a good time.
I think you're just saying that, but I need a serious answer. Like, okay. I honestly feel like you have a grace period for at least the first 2 weeks of January because it's still very new. You're getting to know it. You don't know how it's going to go yet. Is it going to like you? Like, there's all kind of stuff to worry about.
Okay, so. Let's see. Okay, I'm looking at the calendar now. So the first was a Sunday. Okay, so the first, I'm going to say the first through the eighth, you definitely got the green light.
Okay.
Ninth. Today's the 10th. I mean, I'm honestly probably yesterday would have probably been the last day that you could have really said something about the new year.
No, I don't believe that.
I don't think it's 2 weeks. I think it's a week.
No, I'm going to at least the 12th. The 12th. That's where I'm going to go. The cutoff is the 12th, people. That is what we're going with from now on in perpetuity.
All right. I don't agree, but you know what? You seem to really be really concerned about this, so I'll let you have this one.
I'm very concerned. This is a hill I will die on.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, okay, listen up, people. So Avatar 2 has been out for a while. I have not seen it yet. I'm going to maybe go see it at some point. My super fan co-host has not seen it either, and it came out December 16th, but that's okay. I have a question about Avatar 2. I have two, actually one's a question and one's an actual thought that I'm not being argumentative or a jerk. It's a legitimate thing. The first one is, do you think Cameron's going to get any love at the Oscars? Ooh. And do you think Avatar is going to get nominated for Best Picture since there's like what, 20 slots now?
I'm going to be honest. I haven't really been keeping up with the kind of Oscar race. I mean, I would assume.
Well, I mean, just in general, do you think Cameron's going to get it? Like, just.
I mean, I would assume, like, in a normal year that you know, Avatar would get, you know, a nomination or two. But I don't know. Maybe things have changed. Maybe, you know, because Disney now runs everything. You know what I mean? Like, so maybe they don't put him forward in a big campaign because they're mad he spent like $500 million of their money, even though they're going to get it back probably. You know, so I don't know. Maybe there's some kind of new like reality with the Oscars that I don't know about. Maybe, you know, the big white man who does the the big action blockbuster is not going to get nominated. I don't know. Why? What is your read on this? Do you think they're going to, you know, they're going to reward him or no?
I have no idea. That's why I was hoping you would, because I was thinking, well, whatever you say, I'll probably go with, because that sounds right. But then you didn't have anything. So I don't know where to go from here. I would say yes, maybe for Best Picture, because obviously I was being facetious with 20, but I do believe they allow 10 now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's 100% going to get nominated for Best Picture. I mean, if fucking Black Panther 2 is going to get nominated, this is definitely going to get nominated.
Black Panther 2 is going to get nominated for Best Picture?
I'm assuming it is. I mean, the writing's kind of on the wall, isn't it, from a cultural standpoint? So,
Jesus, sorry, I had to clear my throat there.
Yeah. Yes, guys, my co-host is ill, by the way.
Got the fucking
with
plague.
Yeah, whatever the new strand of COVID is, he has it.
It's the unobtainium strand. That's the one I have. Unobtainium variant. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know about the whole Oscar thing, but isn't the expansion to 10 nominees, isn't that, I think it's a direct result of Avatar and Dark Knight not being nominated originally, right?
Oh, I don't know. I thought it was it was a direct result of a comic book movie. I do know that. I just don't know which one.
I know for sure it was Dark. I know for sure the original conversation was Dark Knight, because it was like, how can this movie that was a huge blockbuster and then everybody agrees is fucking awesome, how did it get not get nominated for Best Picture?
I agree. I think taking something into account, like the cultural significance, but it still shouldn't be. I've read several people say they should have like a fan category and let people vote. It's also like for at least a couple of them, because then that would be a way to get audience engagement, since they're dying more and more every year anyway. But I do not think it should be on the Academy. I don't care if it's The Dark Knight or Black Panther 2 or Avatar or whatever. I don't think it should be on the Academy if they were to be taken seriously anymore, to nominate something because it made a lot of money and people talk about it. But that's just me.
Right, right. I mean, I guess cultural significance might be, you know, I mean, especially with such a quick turnaround, right? Like, I think Avatar was released in, like, you know, December, and then the Oscar nominations come out in, like, February or January, you know? So, like, you know, maybe cultural import or whatever is just another way of saying it made a lot of money, you know? Yeah, I don't know, you know? I mean, I'll tell you this. I look back at you know, Oscar stuff sometimes, and I'm like, I know this shit never mattered. These award shows are silly or whatever. But now, man, it seems like they really don't matter, you know? Like, and I don't know. Maybe that could just be me being cynical, but, like, it seems like at one point it'd be like, oh, shit. Like, yeah, like, Alfred Hitchcock came over to Europe in 1940 and made Rebecca and, like, you know, won Best Picture or whatever. And it's like, wow, that's cool, you know? And it's like, now it's like, oh, Coda won Best Picture. What movie is that? No one's ever heard of it. Okay, cool. You know, like, it just seems like it just really doesn't matter now, you know?
Well, I'll tell you this, and then I'm going to cut both of us off so this doesn't branch off into something else. They don't matter now, but they will be dead and buried and decomposing in the ground if Everything Everywhere All at Once wins Best Picture. And we'll find out in about a month.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. I would be shocked if the Letterboxd contingent had taken over the Academy. There's no way. I mean, the Academy, let's be honest, who are these people, right? They're a bunch of, like, old, leathery, old school Hollywood people with a sprinkling of younger, you know, people mixed in to, you know, make it quote unquote more diverse. But, like, no, they're not going to nominate. They're not going to make that movie win Best Picture. At least I don't think. But who knows? I could be wrong. And honestly, who cares? You know,
100% true. But who cares? I don't really know one way or the other. I just know that, you know, I believe that the Golden Globes are airing the day we're recording this, guys. You already said it was the 10th. So they aired on the 10th. And Michelle Yeoh did win for best supporting or best lead. I don't know either way. So I don't know what bearing the Golden Globe has on the Oscars, but honestly, I don't know what bearings the Golden Globes have on anything. So either way, I have my follow-up question to Avatar. Now, dude, I'm not saying this to be mean about Avatar. I'm not being sarcastic. I was thinking about this earlier. I'm being 100% serious. Like, in my opinion, the first Avatar has no real cultural impact outside of making a lot of money. That's just my opinion, and I'm not saying that to argue. I'm saying that to say it blows my mind that as of this recording, it is the Avatar 2 is the fifth highest grossing movie of all time, which is crazy, and I give all the credit to that crew and Cameron, and I'm glad it's working out. I'm glad it's succeeding. I think it's good for the movies that it's succeeding. Like, I'm not rooting against anybody. But a movie that most people, I mean, not a lot of people say they didn't really like, they couldn't. I talked to a lot of people who couldn't make it through the first one or didn't really enjoy it, but they loved the second one. And a movie that no one really talked about for over a decade, except for when it would pop up in the news that Cameron's still working on Avatar 2 and still like inventing new shit for his movie, which is amazing. And this sequel comes out. It's been out less than a month and it is just dominating. That is insane to me and just really impressive. Like, I can't even comprehend it, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I don't know. Just, you know, there are different versions, I think, of cultural impact, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, like, I think there was a lot of, there was a lot of attempts to make the first Avatar seem cheesy. And I don't mean attempts like mean-spirited ones, right? I don't mean that at all. But I mean like, you know, SNL skits or, you know, kind of like, oh, like poking fun, you know, kind of like the Daniel Plainview, I drink your milkshake, you know, little like to turn it into a kind of meme or something, or, you know, a screenshot or, you know, whatever. And like some media, some movies, you know, big blockbuster movies. I mean, and I think Avatar is proof positive of this. Sometimes they're just not susceptible to the kind of things that indicate cultural relevance to us now, right? If that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think Avatar is amenable to that. There's no screenshot. There's no funny, ironic GIF or like meme or like TikTok trend or, you know what I mean? There's nothing there that can really translate into our world because it is a completely, you know, it's a completely different like world building, you know, and like, yeah, I guess I, you know, even thinking of something like Game of Thrones is like the perfect media phenomenon. You know, like to say like it had like Game of Thrones is probably the thing with the biggest cultural footprint over the past 10 years. I mean, does that sound right to you when you say like cultural impact?
Yeah.
Like
no, I agree with that comparison.
Like if you're saying the word cultural impact, like Game of Thrones, I mean, it impacted every aspect of culture, and everybody knew, you know, the characters, even if you didn't watch the show, and everybody talked about it, and everybody watched it. But you're right, Avatar is a movie everybody's seeing, but not a lot of people are talking about. I think, I don't know, thinking of something like Game of Thrones is basically like medieval Europe with dragons, right? But I mean, what is there in our world that is similar to Avatar, right? There's nothing really that, it can't really have an impact on our culture because nothing from our culture resembles Avatar. Like, it's not like, oh yes, this is another one in a long line of this kind of genre movies. It's like, no, there's really not a lot of movies like this. Like, that's why people reach for the Fern Gully comparisons, because it's like, yeah, there's like one other movie like this, and it was a random animated movie from the 90s that no one remembers. You know, like there's really nothing else like it. And so I think that points to the fact that it has no cultural relevance, quote unquote. I'm using that term in quotes because there's nothing to compare it to. It doesn't really apply to our world in any meaningful way. It's pure unfettered escapism. And from what I understand, the second movie quadruples down on that level of escapism from the first movie. So, I mean, whereas like Game of Thrones, it's like bend the knee. Okay, well, how many different, you know, scenarios can we get in our day-to-day lives where we can use the phrase bend the knee or, you know, whatever. But like Avatar, it's just like, nah, man, our world is nothing like it. There's nothing to cross over there. It's just a completely different thing. Cameron has perfected, escapist entertainment, you know? I don't know.
First off,
I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't know.
It does.
Those are my thoughts.
And I'll get to it. But first off, I'm not going to tolerate any Fern Gully slander. Everyone remembers that movie. How dare you even insinuate otherwise? Secondly, I agree with that.
Sorry about that.
I agree with your take, which is what I wanted and why I wanted to bring it up. And why, like I said, I wasn't being condescending or anything about saying the cultural impact of it. Because A, I really am impressed with what this sequel has been able to do. But B, I like the take on there are several instances or several types of cultural impact,
right,
like you said.
Right.
And I think that's a really good way to kind of say it because, yeah, you're right. There's nothing. It is pure escapism, which is why I love it. It is, dude, between that and Top Gun, like we had a 2022 some of the biggest blockbusters, two of the biggest blockbusters of the year, like, were not comic book movies.
Mm.
When's the last time that happened?
Right.
You know? So I think it's awesome. And I am looking forward to seeing the sequel just to experience it. But I'll tell you this, after reading what his plans are for the third one, way more excited for the third one. Like, I will go see that one as soon as it opens, probably.
So, I don't even know about the what he's got planned.
He's gonna introduce a fire Na'vi.
Oh boy.
So, I mean, he's already, like, the Way of Water or whatever the fuck it's called. Like, I love oceans. Like, I love that aspect. So it's gonna be fun to see it. It's just, you've got to make like a real you've got to plan around a 3-hour and 15-minute movie. Right. You don't just go see it. But the third one, like, no, I am all in. I hope it's odd, because that sounds fucking amazing, honestly.
So. Well, fire is also really interesting, because fire is kind of one of the most difficult things to do with CGI, you know? Well, water is too, obviously.
Well, actually, it's funny you say that. If I've said this on the podcast before, I apologize to the listeners, but one of my favorite comments from Cameron has been, when they were like, hey, why do your underwater scenes look so different and better compared to like Aquaman? And he's like, because I film in the fucking water.
Right.
Because Kate Winslet had to hold her breath for 7 minutes. And because my crew and cast was committed to getting these underwater scenes right, which honestly, very few people have ever gotten water right on camera.
Right.
And apparently he did. So that's another reason to be excited to see it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we know how much I've been looking forward to this movie. The reason I haven't seen it yet is simply because, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I won't get into it, obviously, but like, I did not really have a great kind of like holiday season, you know, kind of depressing. And honestly, I wanted to be in a better mood when I saw it, you know. And so I planned on seeing it at the beginning of the year, and then I got really sick. And I was like, well, I got to wait till I get better. Like, I didn't want to be in like a bad headspace or like a bad, you know, bad vibes or whatever. Like, I really, it almost like, I don't know, almost like going to church or something. Like, I wanted to be like, no, I want to be in the right mindset. I want to be like ready to really just sit back and enjoy this thing without, you know, having anything else in my life going on or have, you know. So, yeah, I'm going to go see it this Friday. I'm very excited, obviously. I'm so looking forward to it that I don't want to like fuck it up by like I said, you know, being in a bad mood or whatever. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, thanks for saying that. And now I look like the bad guy for making a joke about it earlier. So thanks. I appreciate it.
Joke? Oh, dear listener.
Oh, no. No, don't even do that. It was a jab at the fact that you haven't seen this movie that's been out for a month that you dreamt about. Ladies and gentlemen, he dreamt about this movie, and now I feel bad for what I said. But am I going to do anything about it? No.
Dear listener, my gentle co-host has done so much worse than that jab. He has berated me. He has mocked me for not seeing this movie. So yeah.
Oh, you're just gonna say that? I thought you were gonna like make fun of the joke. If you're just gonna say that I've abused you off the pod, I'm fine with that.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay, guys. Yeah, this wasn't a break for you, but it was a break for us. We had to take a quick moment. Had to edit some stuff out because my co-host is literally insane.
Hey, what are you gonna do?
So anyway, we're back. Okay, I have one thing to share before we jump into our two movies. I have one thing to share that I have watched that is not podcast related, and I would advise everyone to do the same, especially if you are a fan of 1800s America. The Pale Blue Eye is the new Scott Cooper movie that just hit Netflix last week. It is worth the watch. The kid that plays Edgar Allan Poe is fucking amazing. He holds his own against Christian Bale. I believe he is a Harry Potter alumni. His name is Harry Melling. Anyway, great fucking movie. If you do not like slow moving period pieces, probably not for you.
Wait, Edgar Allan Poe. It's about Edgar Allan Poe.
It is. Well, it's a fake thing. It's like it's based on a novel, but it's all fictitious. Christian Bale is a detective. This isn't a spoiler. It's all in the trailer. is a detective investigating a murder at the academy that Poe attends, and Poe helps him with the murder. It's really fun. It's a little slow, but anyone who's familiar with Scott Cooper movies knows that's kind of his MO. But it's got a pretty good cast. Toby Jones, Gillian Anderson. I think Gillian or Jillian. I don't know. She's the X-Files lady. Mm-hmm. And Robert Duvall on top of the great Christian Bale, of course. So anyway, it's on Netflix. Pretty much everybody has that. It's worth watching. It's 2 hours long. So
All right.
That's my recommendation of the week. The week's recommendation.
Okay.
Do you have anything that's not podcast related before we jump into our features of the week?
No, I don't. I start watching Andor. I haven't really got into it yet, though. I want to watch one episode. Pretty good.
I'm going to channel you when I say this. Is this the silver TV or silver screen TV, or is this the silver screen video?
All right. Let's move on. Movies. Wait, silver screen video would still apply to television, wouldn't it?
I know. I fucked it up. You fucked it up. But last time I brought up TV, which was a while back, you made a smug remark. But that's okay. I'm not going to watch Andor, but I hope you enjoy it.
But wait, you're not? I thought you were going to watch it and you were excited about it.
No, I told you. I got like 10 minutes into the first episode and I was like, this isn't for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm shocked by that.
I'm not saying I'll never watch it. I made it farther into the first episode than I did of the Obi-Wan show. So
I didn't even try to watch that, but I just heard so many good things about Andor. I just assumed you would watch it. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Oh, trust me. I'm on the outs on Andor. Like, right. I clearly think it's me. It's not the show, because the show, I like Gilroy. I think he's great and it's got a great cast and everybody loves it. It's just me. Maybe when I'm in a different mood, I'll watch it. But, you know, some of this Disney shit, you've got to be in a specific mood to, like, enjoy it. And I do believe Andor is legitimately good. I just need to, like, focus and watch it.
Interesting. So. Okay. All right. Well, I'll let you know how it is. I'm excited to watch more of it. Anyways.
Guys, this week our feature, I'm sure you've guessed it since it's the episode title, we are talking about Suspicion. Now, mind you, we are big Cary Grant fans on this podcast. For long-term listeners, you know this already. We believe he's the greatest screen actor in the history of cinema. So Jacob wanted to do a Hitchcock movie with Cary Grant, pick Suspicion. I was happy. I have not seen this movie in years. And yeah, I don't know. So how do you want to jump into this? I mean, it's clearly a serious performance for Grant, which is the main reason that I really enjoyed it. We've talked about Arsenic and Old Lace on this podcast a lot, especially we both bought the Criterion. I watched it over Halloween and I've seen it like 10 times, but this movie is like the exact opposite of that performance.
Interesting.
Which I find to be really interesting.
Why would you compare it to that movie? Just out of curiosity.
You know what? I wasn't going to do it. I was trying to just go along. So guys, originally Jacob had pitched the idea of doing Arsenic and Old Lace and Suspicion. And I said, yeah, let's do it. He just realized that he didn't watch Arsenic and Old Lace, which I was fine with, mind you. But the reason I brought up Arsenic and Old Lace wasn't to prod my co-host, but it was to say, like, comparing these performances, really interesting shit, because Suspicion is not a goofy, mumbly, like talking over other people type of bringing up baby Arsenic and Old Lace performance. It is a kind of a disturbing performance from Cary Grant, and one that honestly I don't like seeing, if I'm being honest. Like, I don't like seeing Cary Grant be this kind of guy.
Well, let me tell you why I wanted to watch Suspicion, because I think we were going to throw another movie in there. I can't remember what it was, but
one we had already talked about. Not Charade. Was it Charade?
Yeah, I think it was Charade we were going to do. But I wanted to talk about Suspicion because I have been really interested in 1940s Hitchcock. And so, like, I was so focused on the kind of interplay between Cary Grant and Hitchcock that I completely forgot. I was like, oh my God, we were going to do the Cary Grant kind of comparison episode. So yeah, I was kind of like too focused on the Hitchcock of it that I completely forgot to fucking watch the other movie, which is my fault. But the reason I changed it to I wanted to add suspicion in here is because I'm really interested in 1940s Hitchcock, and anybody who has listened to the podcast, kind of knows this. I talked about during a What We've Been Watching segment, I talked about Rebecca for for a good 30 minutes, I feel like. And then you watched Rebecca after that, right?
Yeah, and I think we revisited it on the podcast because I remember that episode. You asked me if I had seen it, and I said no, and then you waxed poetic about it for a decent amount, which is fine, but it was just really funny because since I hadn't seen it, at the end of it, I was like, oh yeah, that sounds great.
Sounds great. I'll have to watch it someday.
But then I did watch it, and it was fantastic. It was beautiful.
Right.
A beautiful movie.
Yeah, it's I don't know, Hitchcock because the reason I'm so interested in Hitchcock in the 40s, and I figure, I might as well get into this since we're talking about it, is because his movies are so incredibly different than they were in the late 50s. Because when we think of Hitchcock, we think of, Rear Window, and we think of Vertigo and Psycho and these, kind of like North by Northwest, these major movies that he made in the mid to late 50s and early 60s with Psycho. But then you look back at the movies in his 40s, in the 1940s, and they look like they're made by somebody else. And which, obviously you can say, well, he evolved as a director and stuff. But I'm kind of curious of just how that evolution took place. And because I'm not sure one of them is better than the other, even though the latter, 1950s, definitely most people adore those movies and they do the movies of the 40s. But I don't know, and specifically, I just want to mention just about Rebecca really quick, because it was his first Hollywood movie. Hitchcock in the UK, in Britain, he made these little puzzle box movies, these little problems to solve and little mysteries and little thrillers or whatever. And it was clear he didn't take them very seriously, right? But when he came to Hollywood and made Rebecca with David O. Selznick, who is fresh off of Gone with the Wind in 1939, David O. Selznick and the Hollywood machine forced him to begin to take his genre cinema, his master of thrills thing. Like, we forced him to take that shit seriously, right? And there's a great quote by who else? The great David Thompson in his latest book, A Light in the Dark. I just want to mention this quote real quick. He says, above all, in America, movies were recognized by 1939 as maybe the central amalgam of entertainment and imagination. And this is the key quote. Americans took fantasy for granted. It was their idea of a new chance in life. Whereas in Britain, people were ashamed of that impulse and its promise of disorder, maybe with reason. So you have a Hitchcock who goes from, kind of almost being slightly ashamed of his work, and like, oh, this is all very silly, isn't it? Now all of a sudden he has to take it seriously, right? And that is what Rebecca is. It is a serious gothic women's picture that is filled to the brim with emotion, right? Emotion, you feel bad for this woman. She goes to this house, Manderley, and she's, everybody's talking about the guy's dead ex-wife, and he's acting, weird. He's one of Hitchcock's kind of like broken men, and it's not a great situation for her. And it's just, there's so much emotion wrapped up in this thing, right? Well, then we get to Suspicion. Suspicion is made a year later, and we're still seeing Hitchcock, and as great of a movie as Rebecca is, Hitchcock is struggling against the American studio system, right? He is not completely comfortable yet. He will get that way in the late 50s, right? But he's not completely comfortable yet. He can't completely do what he wants to do and hasn't completely figured out what exactly it is that he's doing here, what his American project is going to be. And we see this borne out in Shadow of a Doubt, which is very much a movie about the American obsession with death and murder, right? The great Joseph Cotten movie, Notorious, we've talked about before on this podcast, which I think is Hitchcock's first masterpiece. Then we have Under Capricorn at the end of the decade, which is really almost Hitchcock's most experimental movie. But the point is, we're talking about Suspicion today, and it's a really complicated movie. Why don't we start there? That was kind of my little preamble, and kind of the lens that I was viewing it through was kind of this is the follow-up to Rebecca. And just to mention a little bit of the background, Hitchcock was on loan for Suspicion, right? David O. Selznick loaned him out to Warner Brothers to do this movie. Obviously he went back to Selznick because he had a contract with him. So he didn't have Selznick kind of watching over him like he did with Rebecca. Rebecca is very much a studio picture, very much a Hitchcock movie, but also very much a studio picture. Whereas for Warner Brothers, they were like, we need somebody to direct this this Cary Grant vehicle we've got. And David O. Selznick was like, well, I'll loan you Hitchcock for this film if you do me X, Y, and Z in the future. And so, so he's out from under the thumb of Selznick for this movie and for Shadow of a Doubt in 1943. So anyways, that kind of as a preamble, what was your overall impression with this movie? You mentioned the major Cary Grant performance, obviously, but do you want to like tell a little bit just about the plot and then kind of your response to the movie overall?
I do. And I also want to say it wasn't Charade. It was Notorious. And we've already talked about that. And that was on episode 89. For those of you that missed that, that was our Hitchcock back when we did kind of volumes of directors. We did Marnie, The Birds, and Notorious.
Okay.
So, just so you guys know, So with Suspicion, I mean, basically I'll read you the IMDb synopsis just so, cause they tend to simplify it a bit. And then we can get into it. A shy young heiress marries a charming gentleman and soon begins to suspect he is planning to murder her. Now, that's a poor synopsis, oddly enough, because a lot happens. It's not like they get married and you're like, oh, shucks, I think you're going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot happens with as Cary Grant's character unfolds. So essentially they meet. She's swept off her feet. Speaking of which, Joan Fontaine does a ridiculously good job. Did she win an Academy Award for this or get nominated?
I actually don't know. I know she won for Rebecca the previous year, so probably not. Yeah, I can check.
Okay. That's what it was. That's what it was. I knew I read she won one, but that's what it was for.
Yeah, I think she won for Rebecca the previous year.
So she gets with Cary Grant's character, and like I said before, I don't like Grant in this kind of slimy character. He's a degenerate gambler. He's a thief. We soon learn he's a murderer. It's really weird. First, her father dies. Then his business partner dies. And then it's like, oh, boy. Like, I wonder, like, she's kind of like watching this like fucking train move towards her. And clearly it's known for its ending, which we'll get to. But I mean, essentially, she sees this unfold in Grant's performance that is ridiculously good. Like, Grant kills it in this role. He's so confident. He's so smooth. But he can also be like, no, like, you're unsettling. You're kind of Anthony Perkins type in some scenes. So I will say his performance just isn't for me as a Cary Grant fan. I would rather see the bringing up baby arsenic and old lace type of Grant opposed to this guy who's fucking hawking chairs to pay gambling debts and stealing from his boss and shit like that.
Right. I do want to clarify. I was dead wrong about this. She was nominated for Rebecca, but she won for Suspicion. Which is interesting. That Rebecca performance, it's tough to imagine. Interesting. Ginger Rogers won that year for Kitty Foyle. Another great performance. You know, what can you say? All right. So, No, I get that. I mean, the Grant performance in this movie is very unsettling. Like, like, it is really unsettling. I mean, we're dealing with someone who is a perpetual fuck up, who is, at the very least, a suicidal fuck up, who is maybe a gambling addict, and, you know, yeah, like, he's not, I don't know, I guess we could talk about spoilers, it's a 80-year-old movie, he's not gonna kill her, but it's like, he's still not a great guy to be married to, right? Like, to...
Also, what do you mean he's not gonna kill her? Because, like, that's part of the ending. Part of the allure of the ending is, like, allegedly the studio didn't want Grant to kill her, because I think the original, I could have misread, I think the original idea was for him to kill her, and they compromised with the hand around her at the end, letting you know, nah, he's still going to kill her.
Oh, really? That's how you read that at the end?
Yeah, that's how I read it. I mean, but did I read it that way because of the other stuff I've read about it? Possibly. Maybe my brain was already there. I don't know.
Here we go. And if the viewer accepts Johnny's statements in the final scene and decides that he is, for all his faults, no murderer, the film becomes a cautionary tale about the dangers of suspicion. However, given his behavior up to this point, it's not clear why Johnny's assertions should be readily believed. In effect, the film leaves the viewer in a perpetual state of suspense as to what the truth is and what might happen next. And that's written in Wikipedia, and it says citation needed. So, which means, I guess it was just written by whoever wrote the Wikipedia article, which is just some guy somewhere. Interesting. You know, I didn't read the ending like that. But I guess it's possible to, you know,
So do you not think that he was a murderer? You think he was just a piece of shit?
Yeah, I think so. You know, just to get into the nitty gritty of it, like, my read on this movie is, you know, this is a film about character, I think. You know, Cary Grant is one of Hitchcock's broken heroes, right? We see this all the time in Hitchcock movies. I mean, you know, Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo,
North by Northwest.
I mean, these are the heroes who have something wrong with them. Something wrong with them. There's nothing else you can say other than that. Psycho, obviously. So this is, Cary Grant is, I think, this maybe his first broken hero. I guess Olivier counts in Rebecca, but Hitchcock is not too concerned with character in Rebecca. With Rebecca, he's more concerned with mood and with, Rebecca is also the movie where Hitchcock discovered production design, because we could actually do it like on a much larger budget than the British could, you know? So that to me is what Rebecca is almost about, is Hitchcock learning that American production design is absolutely unparalleled. But Suspicion, I think, is about this Cary Grant character, right? But what is interesting to me is this seems to be one of those movies. And I didn't look anything up. I don't have any historical evidence to back this up. I don't think Grant and Hitchcock didn't get along or whatever. But when you're watching the movie, it's very interesting because Cary Grant is giving this amazingly nuanced performance, right? And this really kind of sad and pathetic performance while also very charming but he's also curt and he's also a little creepy. And it's just, it's a classic Cary Grant performance in the sense that it's such a good performance of his because it showcases exactly what made him a great actor. The thing that made him a great actor was he was able to produce about 35 different emotions at once and then shift it a little bit. And the next moment he's doing 34 different emotions. And the next minute he's doing a little bit of this, and he's shifting and shaping his performance on a second to second basis. Right. So that literally one second he seems creepy, and the next second he seems charming, and then the next second he seems like a murderer, the next second he seems like a fuck up, you know, and that's why I think this is such an amazing Cary Grant performance. But I will say, is Hitchcock interested in any of this shit? Because I don't think he is. I think Hitchcock is literally just interested in turning the screws on the audience. He's just interested in wringing the audience dry with the suspense of, oh no, is Cary Grant a murderer? And making you think he's a murderer. And then of course you get to the end and it's like, oh, he's not a murderer. He's just a fuck up. He's just, you know, suicidal or whatever. And like Hitchcock is so concerned with the mechanism, right? He's concerned with putting the audience through that vice grip that he loved to put the audience through, this kind of torture chamber almost. Whereas Cary Grant is giving like the performance of his or any other person's life in this movie, you know, like, I don't know. That's kind of the read I got on it. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I 100% agree. And I think that's kind of what makes the movie so much fun. And I think that's what made the movie so much fun back in 1941, I think it was, when it came out, is because that's all Hitchcock wants to do, which, while on the one hand, that's fun. But on the other hand, we have talked about, like, certain things are called into question about whether or not he's a true artist by habits like that. Mm. You just want to torture your audience. You storyboard so well and all this, you don't even have to be on set. Like, what are you artistically, like, you're a robot. It's the same argument that you make for Kubrick, which I also agree with. Kubrick was more robot than man, you know? And that's how Hitchcock is. So I think the perfect storm of that, which Hitchcock being like, no, we're going to take Cary Grant, who is like the it guy who everybody loves. We're going to put him in this movie and I'm just going to fuck with people for like an hour and 15 minutes.
I'm going to convince everybody in the theater that the most charming man in the world is a murderer. It's a game to him.
Yeah, and like the reason I'm saying about an hour and 15 is because we're just settling in the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're getting to know him and we're getting to know her and their relationship, and it's just really interesting to see once that gets going, then it's like, oh shit, like he clearly doesn't get along with her father, then her father ends up dead, and then she starts to have these fantasies, dreams, things like that about, oh shit, did he, like, is he going to fucking kill his business partner? And I love when his business partner shows up and he tells the story about, oh, he saved my life, because then it's just like, no, at this point, the word wasn't around then, but at this point you're trolling the audience.
Yeah.
Because it's like, no, he's still alive. And then the wife's like, oh, thank God, she's so relieved. And then he dies under mysterious circumstances. Right. So I don't know. He just goes back and forth so beautifully. So it's the perfect storm of Hitchcock wanting to be like, no, we want to make the audience be unsure. We want them on the edge of their seat. We want them thinking, could the most charming man on the planet really be a serial killer? And then you combine that with Grant and Fontaine's performances, and you really do have the perfect fucking storm for a movie. Like, the fact that this isn't discussed in like A-tier Hitchcock, when you start reading and hearing about Hitchcock, kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not as tidy as other Hitchcock movies, right? It may seem that way at first, because there really is only one mechanism of terror or suspense, which is, you know, is Cary Grant a killer? But it doesn't mesh as well as, you know, some of other Hitchcock thrillers. And I think there's a reason for that. I think it is because of Cary Grant's like just complex performance and the way that he is just, I don't know, man, just the way that he is just like, he's like a violin virtuoso playing his body, you know, and manipulating it and his face and everything. Meanwhile, Hitchcock is like the guy behind the curtains, like, holy shit, man, everybody thinks he's a murderer. This is hilarious, you know? Like, and Cary Grant's like, I'm giving the performance of my life over here. Like, like, it's such a great little, I don't know. It's such a great little feisty movie, you know, like it's not like a clean cut masterpiece of something like Rear Window, like, or Vertigo, you know. Vertigo, Hitchcock and Jimmy Stewart, they both know exactly what each other want. They're in perfect simpatico, you know, whatever. But this movie's a little messy, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I like it so well.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not, if you compare it to some other ones that I think are A tier Hitchcock, like a Psycho or like a Rear Window, clearly it's a little different, like in terms of his regular layout. But there's still something about this movie, man, that really, like, upon revisiting it, I was just like, this is the fucking greatest thing ever. It's just been so long since I watched it.
I'm glad you liked it. What about comparing it to Rebecca? Because I know it hasn't been that long since I basically forced you to watch Rebecca. Because I from the historical, you know, kind of record or whatever, you know, Hitchcock did not like working with Selznick, because Selznick had just made Gone with the Wind, so you couldn't tell him shit, you know what I mean? Even if you were a little Mr. Hitchcock from the UK, right? Like, you couldn't tell Selznick shit. And so Hitchcock didn't like working with Selznick on Rebecca, even though Rebecca is still a great movie. And so with Suspicion, he didn't really have anybody over his head and could kind of do exactly what he wanted to do. Does that bear out? I don't know. What do you think the differences are between Rebecca and Hitchcock, or Rebecca and Suspicion?
I mean, honestly, I think the for me, the biggest difference is Suspicion was significantly better. I think you like that movie way more than me. Not that I disliked it, but I do think Suspicion is on a whole different level in terms of how he builds the suspense and how he operates. Now, in terms of his directing style, I didn't see a ton of difference, honestly. But I think the story, and clearly Grant being in front of the camera, really alters how it's received.
Yeah, no, Suspicion is definitely more of a Hitchcock movie. It's got more suspense, you know, and it's got an amazing performance by Grant. Rebecca is more of like a classical Hollywood film, which is probably why I like it more, because I would take the average high quality classic Hollywood film over a Hitchcock film. That's just my personal preference. Yeah, I don't know. I'm glad you liked it, because it's Grant is otherworldly in this movie. I think this, you know, if it doesn't deserve to be, which maybe it does, I'm not saying it doesn't, but if it never makes it into the A tier of Hitchcock movies, this should definitely be in the A tier of Cary Grant performances, because he's unreal in it. Like, he his mastery of his instrument is just so, I don't know, man. It's just so great. And it's, when you think about it, made in 1941, this is him right on the heels of a string of successful screwball comedies, right? His Girl Friday was 1940. Bringing Up Baby, I think it's 36. Philadelphia,
I think it's 38.
Okay. I think Philadelphia Story is 1940, I believe. So, I mean, you know, Cary Grant is on a run of, you know, classic, iconic Hollywood comedies. And then you can see him just chomping at the bit to be able to take a role like this, you know, where he may be a murderer. And even if he's not a murderer, he's a fuck up. He's a degenerate gambler who's like, dude, he sold those chairs, man. How fucked up is that?
Yeah, I mean, even if he's not a murderer, which I'm not convinced that he isn't, he stole the chairs. He stole 2,000 pounds. I mean, he's a bad guy. He's a liar. He's shifty. Like, he's just not. I mean, honestly, I'm not even going to say he's not a good husband. I'm going to say, like, not to victim blame, but she had a few red flags before they got married.
Oh yeah.
And clearly he's just, like, to put it in like super reductive terms, he's not a house cat.
Right.
Like, so it was a fool's errand to try to domesticate him, especially in his case. So,
dude, what about whenever they're reading her father's will and he is like visibly pissed? Like, he's just like everybody's sitting around in like morning clothes, and like it's Cary Grant, so he does it very, very subtly. But you could just see on his face, he's just like, are you fucking kidding me? This motherfucker didn't leave us anything. Like,
yeah. And then it's like, well, clearly, like, it's you know, he didn't like us. And like, he leaves the room to go get a drink. Like, the way he plays the whole scene. And then, like, he basically, like, to use a term that's came into popularity, I guess, over the last few years or so, he basically, like, gaslights her a little bit on, oh, on how much money they got.
Yeah.
Which, once again, not to victim blame, but I mean, look, man, I think it was Oscar Wilde said, if someone shows you who they really are, believe them, right. kind of thing. Right. So,
yeah,
actually, I may be conflating my quotes. That might be Maya Angelou, because Oscar Wilde has a mass quote. I take that back. Sorry.
Either way, it's dead accurate. But no, you're right. There are a bunch of red flags where like the first time they meet on that cliff, and she's like, stop touching the top of or the bottom of my throat. Like, he's like,
yeah. And then it's like, your hair, there's something wrong with your hair.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay. And then you're like pawing her hair like a raccoon.
Let me ask you this. Is Cary Grant is he the very first incel in this movie? Because there really is, like, he really, this fool, this man is acting like he's never been out of the house before, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely something about, especially just in the beginning when he's like, hey, let me see your ticket. And it's like, oh, you're selling first class tickets at third class tickets at first class prices now and stuff like that. And it's like, you're just being a bitch when you're clearly in the wrong. I don't know if there's something wrong with you. You can't communicate properly with other individuals. yeah, dude, I would say there's just some problems.
He's a guy, maybe got a bit of the autism, you know, to him.
I could see that as well.
Yeah, that scene is so good because, like, it's Cary Grant, so you think he's going to charm his way out of that situation. You know, because he has a third, for those, anybody who hasn't seen it, he gets caught with a third class ticket in a first class compartment. And he's like trying to make jokes and trying to like, oh, you know, blah, 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 you know. And finally, like, nobody's buying it. And so he just looks directly at Joan Fontaine, who is the camera's POV. So he looks directly into the camera and he goes, pardon me, do you have any money?
Yeah.
Like, you think he's gonna, like,
he basically says, I know we've just met, but do you have any coins?
Right, right. And like, it then, like, she's like browsing through her purse and he like reaches in and grabs something. He grabs like a stamp and says, this is legal tender, buddy. I don't know what that meant. I don't know what that was. But yeah, it's so amazing because you think it's Cary Grant. He's going to charm the socks off this woman, and he never does. He never charms the socks off her. He can be charming in certain instances, but this is not the Cary Grant charm offensive. This is this guy's just he's bumbling around, you know, flying by the seat of his pants.
Yeah, which is exactly why, like I said, not to victim blame, like, this has to be on her a bit, because he was never all that charming. Like, he was never the guy that should, like, sweep you off your feet. He was weird and nerdy and cave troll like.
Cave troll. This was he a proto gamer? Is that what Cary Grant is in this movie?
I mean, I don't want to make our gaming listeners upset, so
you know what? You know what? You could have went along with me on that one.
I'm going along on the incel thing, and that's why it pains me to see Cary Grant in this performance. Like, I don't like it, dude. It's not like, clearly it's worse than like the His Girl Friday performance, which I still stand by. He's an asshole in that movie. But dude, I'm sorry. I want laid back, charming, fun Cary Grant. Like, I don't want the Cary Grant that may or may not murder me in my sleep.
Dude, what about when he's carrying that giant glass of milk? It's like, never has a glass of milk existed on the earth that is not going to get drank as much as that glass of milk. Like, like, it's just something darkly comic about him carrying that all the way up those stairs. And That's great. And then when they get back from the honeymoon, they go on like the honeymoon of like, I don't know, a king or a prince or something. They like go all over like the Riviera, Mediterranean, and then they come back to this like amazing house. She's like, "Who's paying for all this?" He's like, "Hell if I know."
Well, it's like, you know, I thought your dad would pay for it, and then it's like, oh well, fuck it, I'll just borrow more money, right. And it's like, this is a problem.
Oh man, good stuff. All right, man, you got anything else on Suspicion? I don't know. I liked it. The last thing
I'll say about it is what got on my nerves the most, and what possibly was the most egregious, is the nickname he gave her. I was ready to
Monkey
punch
face.
Him in the face.
Right.
What the actual fuck kind of nickname is that?
Well, you don't think it's romantic to call your new young beautiful wife Monkey Face?
Yeah, get out of here, you old monkey face. Yeah, that sounds fucking great.
And he never's like monkey face. Oh, you know, I'm just kidding. I love you. He's just like, get over here, monkey face. Like,
yeah, like she's like, I forgot what scene it was, but she was clearly distraught, and like it's like imagine if your spouse, significant other, whatever, has a nickname for you, and it's funny and it's endearing, and then you just found out, I don't know, your dad's dead, and right. They walk up and they use it on you. It's like, hey, yo, monkey face.
Oh, monkey face.
I'm sorry.
Are you
sad?
Are you sad that your dad just died? How much did he leave us, by the way?
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. The nickname was bad, but in all honesty, guys, watch this movie. Like, if you haven't seen it, or if you haven't seen it in a while, watch it. It is worth it just for Grant's performance. Like, it is, and Fontaine too. She was great reacting to him and rolling with everything. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I still stand by that Kubrick's better than Hitchcock, but that's a conversation for another day.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Why'd you have to bring that shit up?
Just to get that reaction out of you.
God damn it. I'm so sick of your bullshit. I quit the podcast.
And now you're going to be thinking about it all night. Speaking of which, this is another late night episode from us, guys.
And you can tell.
At some point, we're gonna have to stop being night trolls and go back to recording when it's not like 2 in the morning or something.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not 2 in the morning now. It's
Yeah, you didn't have to say that, though. You could have just go.
No, you didn't go with me and my... you didn't. I don't know. You didn't go with me on something a minute ago.
I went with you on the incel thing. I didn't go with you on the gamer thing.
All right.
But either way, guys, let us know if you watch this. Let us know what you think about it. Also, for all you people who have been look real quick. There's been two types of people that we've been hearing from.
Uh-oh.
The last week. We've been hearing from the people who were like, "Oh man, I'm glad you guys said it because I don't understand all the love for everything everywhere." For those people, we appreciate it. There are more of us, I think, than the lovers of that movie want to admit. And for you people that loved it, look, get over it. Like, we didn't like it. That's okay. You can still love it. Don't try to convince me there's something that I'm missing or I don't understand it or this or that. Don't like it. I'm not even convinced it's a real movie. I'm sorry, but that's how we feel. So
I'm not even convinced it's a real movie. That's a good take, actually. Let's roll that out next week. Everything Everywhere All at Once. By the way, thanks for mentioning that movie again. By the way, when we had a nice episode talking about Hitchcock and Cary Grant stuff, and you got to bring up this fucking dog shit from 2022.
Well, I got in the mood because I was razzing you about that movie, Hitchcock and Kubrick. And then I was like, well, no, fuck it. I'm going to go and say that because I do appreciate the people that reached out. But the other people, I'm sorry. Like, it's okay. Like, a lot of people... I mean, dude, our top 10 lists are going to be so different. You literally hate two movies that are on my top 10, which we're not going to spoil now. That's the beauty of movies, people. So get the fuck over it. I'm sorry.
I don't know if that... I don't know if that's the beauty of movies, I think.
Well, it is. Like, it's just... It's different takes, man. What's the old saying? Different strokes for different folks. I mean, so...
But enough about my sex life. Oh...
One more thing that I was going to say about I feel like the two best takes for that movie came out of this podcast. One of them you tweeted, which was if you want to experience it through what feels like a bunch of SNL digital shorts strung together. And you tweeted that. And then last week I made the Rick and Morty interdimensional cable. reference. I think those are two of the most clear takes that can be given on this movie. So
yeah, that's actually really good. It's the aesthetics of it are very late second Obama second Obama term, you know, 09 to 2012. Like that's where this movie kind of lives, you know?
Sure, I guess.
What do you mean? Sure. That's when the digital shorts were coming out, and that's when Rick and Morty
the digital shorts. Yeah, I get it.
They came out at the same time period, like 2009 to like 2012, you know.
I mean, yeah.
Jesus Christ. All right, let's just end this.
Well, I was looking up when Rick and Morty started, cuz it's 2013. I didn't think they started that early. Anyway. Guys, we appreciate you listening. We don't say that enough for all our loyal listeners. Thank you. But we do need to ask our loyal listeners, because there are a lot of you, contrary to what people who disagree with our take on that movie might believe, there are a lot of you. So we need you to do two things. We need you to tell your friends, tell anybody that cares about movies to check us out. And we need you to rate and review wherever you listen, people. Spotify, iTunes, whatever the fuck app you use, Google, whatever. Just hit the stars. Just hit the 5 stars. Big help for the algorithm. We try to ask very little from you guys because we appreciate you listening. There's like a fucking billion podcasts out there. So rate and review if you can. We really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Jacob, do you have anything to add that's constructive before we get out of here?
No, let's wrap it up.
So yeah, I threw in constructive.
Yeah. I see what you did there.
Slow you down. Anyway. Okay, guys. Thanks for stopping by the Silver Screen Video. We will see you next week.